Welcome to the National CCL meeting. I'm your Executive Director, Madeline Farah, and your host today. For the first time, we're offering American Sign Language interpretation during this meeting. So a great big welcome to our interpreters, Sharon and Sarah. I also want to thank all of you who made monthly pledges this month as part of our March fundraiser. Renee Pettengill will tell us more later. Today, we'll hear from Dr. Jennifer Carman of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. We'll savor what you've been doing in the last month, go over our actions for this month, and talk about how the invasion of Ukraine impacts our work. Registration for the June 11th to 13th National Conference is just open. And thank you very much to all the staff that worked so hard on. So our guest this month is Dr. Jennifer Carman. She's a postdoctoral associate with the Yale Program on Climate Change Communications, and her research focuses on identifying and supporting behaviors that individuals and communities can take to adapt to both short and long-term climate change impacts. Jennifer, first I want to tell you just a little bit about the people that you're speaking to, and then we'll turn things right over to you. So the folks on this call, they are the alarmed and active, and they're going to use what you teach us today in their lobbying, in their media work, in presentations, and in conversations wherever they are. They are the people who show up. They show up to help with the work, to educate themselves and others, and to support each other in hard times. If you were speaking to them live, you would see them huddled in the hallway at the hotel making plans. Then after your talk, they would gather around you to ask more questions for as long as you would stay. You would see how they make every new person feel welcome to the work in the organization. These are people who are so committed to solving the climate problem that they're often doing things outside their comfort zone. I love being with them. I love being with you. Soon, I'm going to be peering at the June conference registration list to see who I can look forward to seeing or maybe even hugging after 3 years away from our big June event. And I'm looking forward to meeting people that I've only seen on Zoom. So Jennifer, thank you so much for making time to talk with us today about the work being done by the Yale Project on Climate Change Communications. We have cherished that work for so long, and I'll turn it over to you.
So thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Jennifer Carman, as Madeline said, and I'm a postdoctoral associate at the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. I'm very excited to be here and to talk to you about building support for climate action in the United States. And before I get started, I want to give you a little bit about myself. I have been at YPCCC since September of 2020, but before working there, I was a big fan of their work and had been following them for the better part of a decade, even before I started grad school. And since I have a PhD, that was a long time ago. And so my own background is in conducting survey research for evaluations of energy conservation behavior programs run by utilities in the US. And I went to grad school to study environmental communication and education methods to promote action on climate. And so at YPCCC, I'm part of the survey research team, and I work with them on data collection efforts in the US and internationally, including the Climate Change in the American Mind study, also called CCAM. And so to give you an overview of what I'll be talking about today, first, I will be going through some of our recent findings on Americans' attitudes towards climate change, and then I will be talking about some of the communication tools and resources that we've developed to share this data. And then finally, I'll go through some key lessons about communicating climate that we've developed based on research, and then I'll open it up for questions. So here I'll share some latest research from our national study, Climate Change in the American Mind. And many of you may be familiar with this. It's been running since 2008 in partnership with George Mason University. And it collects data twice a year from a representative sample of the American public, collecting information on their attitudes toward climate change. And so many of you also may be familiar with Global Warming Six Americas, which we identify from this research. But for those of you who aren't, YPCCC's research has identified six different audiences for climate change messaging in the US. And they are on a spectrum of people who have the highest belief in global warming, are the most concerned, and are the most motivated to act on it, to the people who have the lowest belief in global warming, are least concerned and least motivated to act. And so these are those six audiences, which Madeline referred to in her opening, the alarmed, who are the people who are most worried, think that it will impact them personally, most motivated to act. And as she mentioned, a lot of you, I think, fall into this category, as do I. And so the concerned, people who are worried, but not as much as the alarmed, the cautious people who think that climate change is happening, but not necessarily that it will affect them personally, the disengaged people who don't have much of an opinion one way or the other about the issue, the doubtful people who are on the fence on whether climate change is really happening, and the dismissives who are the sort of classic like deniers, the people who think that global warming is a hoax, et cetera. But as Madeline mentioned, in the opening mentioned that most people in the US fall into the alarmed and the concerned, that about 60% of the Americans fell into these categories in our most recent data collection. And one in three Americans, in fact, falls into the alarmed and is now the largest group. And we've also found that the alarmed has been a growing audience over time. And this chart shows the trends in the sizes of the six Americas in the last 5 years of data collection that we've done. And this shows that the alarmed segment has grown by 15 percentage points since 2017 in the last 5 years, while the dismissive and every other segment has stayed the same or shrunk in size. And so overall, what this shows is that Americans are becoming more worried about global warming, more engaged with the issue, and more supportive of climate solutions. And we've also found from more recent research is that many of the alarmed are active on climate. And so about one in three people who are alarmed are in this active group, which means that they're participating or are highly willing to participate in political actions to address climate change. And so what this translates to mathematically is about one in 10 Americans really want to be involved on climate action. And moreover, about half of these alarmed are willing to engage in these actions. And we found from our research that one of the big barriers that prevents people is that no one has asked. And so these represent really important opportunities for engagement. And this growth in the alarmed is also translating into more specific support for action in the US. And in fact, we found that support for federal action on global warming increased in 2021. And this chart here shows the percentage of registered voters in the US who think that global warming should be a priority for the president and Congress. And YPCCC has been tracking this question since 2008, as long as we've been running this study. And this chart also shows the breakdown in support by political ideology. And so at the top in the dark blue is liberal Democrats. The next line down is moderate and conservative Democrats, and then liberal and moderate Republicans, and then conservative Republicans. And the overall trend lines here show that since 2014, there's been a steady increase in support for climate action among Democrats. But what this chart also shows is that in September of 2021, which you can see on the far right of the chart and is our most recent data, support for federal action on global warming increased for all of these groups, and especially for liberal and moderate Republicans, where support was 10 percentage points higher than it was in the spring of 2021. We also found that most registered voters support many climate-friendly energy policies. And this chart here breaks down support for specific policies that we measured in September of 2021. And like on the previous chart, liberal Democrats are in dark blue, moderate and conservative Democrats are in light blue, liberal and moderate Republicans are in pink, and conservative Republicans are in dark red. And the black diamond represents registered voters overall. And so there are some patterns here that you can see in this support. Some policies have pretty strong bipartisan support, including majority support from conservative Republicans. And these include policies like providing tax incentives or rebates to homeowners, landlords, and businesses to make existing buildings more energy efficient, funding more research into renewable energy sources, such as solar and wind power, providing tax rebates for people who purchase energy efficient vehicles or solar panels, and providing tax rebates or incentives to homeowners, landlords, and businesses to purchase appliances that can be powered without burning fossil fuels, so like electrification policies. And there are some policies that have more divided support, and these tend to be the ones that are more ambitious. And these include things like transitioning the US economy, including electric utilities, transportation, buildings, and industry from fossil fuels to 100% clean energy by 2050. Increasing federal funding to low-income communities and communities of color who are disproportionately harmed by air and water pollution, and requiring fossil fuel companies to pay a carbon tax and use the money to reduce other taxes, such as income tax, by an equal amount. And so this is probably one that's familiar, especially to this audience. And one thing to note is that the wording is close to, but not exactly the same as the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. The reason for that is to keep the wording relatively short and also to track it over time. But I think this is close wording that we have here. But the fourth one is to require electric utilities to produce 100% of their electricity from wind, solar, and other renewable energy resources by the year 2035. Another pattern that emerges here that's notable is that while Republicans are pretty divided in their support for climate action and their support varies across these policies, Democrats aren't really. Even among moderate and conservative Democrats, support for all of these measures is at about 80% or higher. And this suggests that Democratic constituencies in particular are supportive of taking on a pretty ambitious suite of actions to address climate change. And so those are some of our recent key findings regarding political support for climate action in the US. And overall, this shows that there are really major opportunities for climate action right now. But one of my YPCCC's priorities as an organization is helping people like you in the climate movement use our data to take advantage of these opportunities. And so we've developed several communication tools and resources to do just that. And so here I'm going to shift to talking about some of those tools and resources and how you can use them. One of these really important resources is the Yale Climate Opinion Maps, which show how Americans' climate change beliefs, risk perceptions, and policy support vary at the state, congressional district, metro area, and county levels. And these percentages are based on aggregated results from the Climate Change in the American Mind study and are updated every year. And so this most recent update, which includes 2021 data, was actually published just 2 weeks ago. So this is very hot off the presses. And these maps show public opinion on a range of measures, but here I'll focus specifically on the percentage of adults who support a revenue neutral carbon tax on fossil fuel companies. And so here you can see the distribution of support at the county level, and yellows and oranges show where more than half of people support a carbon tax, and blues show where less than half of people support it. And this tool also allows you to look at specific county level estimates and look at how they compare to the national average. So for example, in Dallas County, which is an urban area, the support for a carbon tax is at 71%, which is 5 percentage points higher than the national average. And in Alachua County, Florida, which is where the University of Florida is, the levels of support are similar. But you can also see, looking at this, that even in more conservative areas of the US, there are still substantial proportions of people who support a revenue neutral carbon tax. And so, for example, in Yavapai County, Arizona, which is the most conservative county in Arizona historically, support is at 54%. So lower than the national average, but still about half of people. And in Moffat County, Colorado, which is also a conservative area of Colorado, support is at 43%. And what's notable about this map is that it can identify places where support is high, such as Dallas and Alachua counties. But even in places with lower support and are more conservative, the proportion of people who support it is still quite high. It's not zero. It's not even close. And so this shows places where that people, even if they are activated and organized, they can still form the basis for an effective movement. Another tool that we offer is the Fact Sheets tool, which lets you create a customized one-page summary of public opinion on a range of questions for a specific location. And this basically takes all the data from the maps that I just showed you and summarizes them for either a state or county or congressional district. And these have just been updated also with data from 2021. And this is an example of generated from Moffat County, Colorado, which I just showed you on the previous slide. And this includes data for the county with some comparisons to the state at large. And so while Moffat County is pretty conservative, these graphs here show that even in Moffat County, most residents perceive some risks from climate change and support some policies to address it. So for example, most people in Moffat County think that global warming is going to harm future generations and harm people in developing countries and people in the United States. They also support funding research into renewable energy sources, providing tax rebates for energy efficient vehicles or solar panels, and even regulating CO2 as a pollutant. And also the majorities of people in Moffat County, Colorado think, so as down here, you can see that they support that 57% think that citizens should do more and that corporations should do more to address global warming. And so once again, you can see that there are substantial bases of support there. And even on measures where supporters aren't a majority, there's still a substantial proportion of the population. So 39% of people, for example, think that climate change will harm them personally. And that's not a 0% of the population. So that's important to keep in mind as well. And so the purpose of this tool is to really give you key information that you need about public opinion on global warming in your location. And so one thing that I want to share is, how can you find this tool? And so here is a QR code that you can use to look at on your phone right now if you want. And I share this realizing that people may be doing that now. That can take you directly to our website, and as well as our a bit.ly link, a bit.ly/climateopinionfacts, which will take you directly to the tool that you can do. And I also, this also has been updated with data for 2021 based on the climate opinion maps data. And so once you go there, you can pick out what location you want to focus on and which questions you want to show. And so you can customize all of these. And there's also a button there that allows you to produce these fact sheets in Spanish. And once you hit generate fact sheet, it'll produce what you see on the left-hand side of the screen here. And so what's also notable is that really this is designed to be shared. And so there are little buttons up here that show where you can output results to a printable PDF or tweet them on social media or share them on social media and create URLs to paste them wherever you want to put them. So this is definitely a tool to like play with and share, and I definitely invite you to do that. And so both of these tools are available for free on our website. And to find them, you go to our website, which is climatechange.yale.edu. And you just go to our visualizations and data and all visualizations and data, and it will take you right there. And we also offer many other tools, and such as the what's called the SASE tool, which is a Six Americas super short survey, which lets individuals determine which of the six Americas they fall into, so answer a few questions. But it can also help organizations figure out the distribution of the six Americas in their audiences. And there are many, many other tools there as well. And finally, you can also sign up for our mailing list if you're not on there already, to keep updated on our new research and tools as they come out. I personally have been on that list since 2012, and I find it super helpful. And so now that I've gone through the details of some of our recent findings and our tools to help you use our research, I'd like to take a step back out to some of the big picture lessons that we've learned from our work. And our top recommendation is always that the most important action you can take on climate change is to talk about it. And we say this because, as you've seen here, many people support climate action, but don't know that the other people around them support it, creating what's called a spiral of silence. And one of the things, and one of the major things that CCL does, I think, is actually break that spiral. So here, what I'm going to focus on is, what do we know about how to talk about climate change? And at YPCCC, we've identified, based on our research, five sort of key facts to communicate about climate change of 2 words each. And so 10 words total. 1, it's real. 2, it's us. 3, it's bad. 4, scientists agree. And 5, there's hope. So it's real. Climate change is real. It's happening. It's us. Humans have caused it. It's bad. It's harmful to people, to plants and animals now and in the future. Scientists agree. There's consensus among scientists that global warming is happening. But also there's hope that there are things that people can do to address these issues that humans can do something. And so another important thing to note is that which of these messages to focus on varies based on audience. So thinking back to those six Americas audiences that I've talked about, like people who are more on the fence, the more doubtful, the disengaged, the cautious, focusing on messages like it's real, it's us, and it's bad is more necessary. And the scientists agree message can be an important way to talk to those audiences. We have done research that shows that teaching people about the scientific consensus in particular is an effective way to move people's attitudes on understanding that among cautious and more doubtful audiences that, you know, it's real, it's us, and it's bad. Whereas for audiences who are more concerned and alarmed, the there's hope message is actually much more important, because I think maybe many of you feel this. I feel this sometimes, is just like overwhelmed with climate change and feeling like what we do doesn't matter. And teaching people and giving and understanding that hope, that there is there are actions that people can take to address climate change is really important, especially for people who are more alarmed, and moving them toward action. And so the there's hope message is especially important. Another way to talk about climate change is by sharing personal stories, because personal stories are powerful. And so for here, I'm sharing actually a map, but this is data collected by FEMA and visualized by the Washington Post, so not by us. But I think that it's really useful for thinking about how climate change impacts people and where personal stories can come from. This map shows that 40% of Americans live in counties that experienced a climate disaster last year. And so you may be in one of them, I am. And so this can provide a jumping off point for talking about climate change, because climate change is leading to more frequent and intense weather disasters. But even if you don't live in one of these counties, climate change affects people in non-disaster ways, such as more hot days and higher temperatures. I saw in the chat at the beginning, people talking about getting snow in places that don't normally get snow. And actually where I live, we're getting a lot less snow than we normally would. And so many of us have stories about how we've experienced climate change. For example, like I live in Connecticut now, but I used to live in the East Bay area in California. And my friends who are still there are experiencing fire threats in a way that I never did when I lived there. People talk about, for example, preparing for a fire that burns to the bay, which has never happened before. And people live with smoke and heat impacts in a way that they never used to, but in the summer at least. And so I encourage all of you as well to reflect on this, how climate change has affected you and your community, as a way to start those discussions, because those are where climate action starts. Another strategy that we recommend is persuasion through trusted messengers. And this is especially important for audiences who are more on the fence about climate change and the need for action, which includes, but not is not exclusive to Republicans. And for example, one of our recent research projects was the New Climate Voices campaign. And this campaign targeted Republicans and relied on trusted messengers, like the person who's pictured here, who is retired Air Force General Ron Keyes, and used messages that aligned with people's values, such as talking about the national security threat of climate change. And as a result, this campaign shifted Republicans' views to be more positive on climate change. And so in summary, Americans are becoming increasingly alarmed about climate change and have been over the past several years. And next, most Americans support actions to address climate change, including a wide range of potential federal level policies. And most Americans think that the US government should prioritize these actions. And then finally, YPCCC offers an array of database tools to help your work, including tools that you can use to look at public opinion on climate change in your local area. So with that concludes my main remarks. Thank you all again so much for having me and for bearing with those technical issues at the beginning. And thank you to our research partners at George Mason University and our funders who make this work possible. And finally, thank you all for the work that you do. I think it's so incredibly important and I'm very honored to be here today. And so thank you again. And with that, I will turn it over for questions.
All right, thank you, Dr. Carmen. So we have a lot of questions in the chat where people are wondering about the methodology. So can you just talk about the sample size, how you get such granularity in the maps? How do you guys go about conducting the survey and translating it into this data?
Sure. So there are two different methods sort of at play here. So one is the method that we use for data collection for the Climate Change in the American Mind study. And for that, we use the Ipsos Knowledge Panel. And we collect data from about 1,000 people per wave. Each wave of data collection, meaning like September of 2021 is one wave, March of 2021 is one wave. So it's about 2,000 people per year. And over all of the waves that we've collected, I think that the upcoming, like I think the most recent one was like 27. So I think that we've collected data from about 22,000 people overall since 2008, maybe 23,000. We collect that through the Ipsos Knowledge Panel, which is an online panel that has a panel of people who take an online survey. It also provides people who don't have internet access with computers and internet access to ensure that people who might otherwise be left out of online panels from like a sampling perspective are included. So it's a really representative sample of the broader American public. And so, yeah, we send that data, we write up the survey, we send it out, we field it, we get it back, and but we also aggregate it over time. And so the Yale Climate Opinion Maps are an analysis of that data based on the aggregated data. There's a whole methods paper about it that I don't want to get too much into the details about, but it uses that data and aggregates it over time to conduct an analysis predicting the distribution. It's an analysis that predicts the distribution of where these opinions will be based on location, based on like a big formula of of all sorts of geographic and demographic data. And so it creates estimates of how these will be distributed, but it also gets updated every time we get, every year. So every time we have two waves of data. I hope that that's enough information, but I can also link people to, like, if you really, really want to dive into it, we do provide more details on the methodology on the website for the tool. And there's like a peer reviewed paper if you're a real data nerd and really want to dig into it. But yeah, the data from the data collection gets put into those maps in aggregate.
That's great. Thank you. I
think we can do one or two maybe questions, and everybody should know that there's lots of links in the chat, so you can also go to the source.
Okay. Well, I will ask one more. So we had a few questions on the patterns of support for climate action, such as a dip in the early 2010s, maybe a peak in 2021. Can you speak to anything that you have learned from the data about those peaks and valleys and maybe why?
Yeah. And because I'm newer here, like I don't have the wisdom of the people who've been here for a long time, but I do know that the dip in 2020 or 2010 was something that happened across the board, like on a lot of climate change attitude and policy support indicators, not just the one that I showed here. There was just, there are all sorts of reasons why that may have happened. I think that the first wave of data collection happened before Obama was elected, and the second wave of data collection happened after Obama was elected. There was the financial crisis, like climate change became much more politicized around that time. So it led to like overall decreases in support in the American public, I think in part because people were really engaging with climate change at that time in a way that they hadn't been before, and once it becomes a political issue in America, it becomes much more divided. And whereas in 2021, this is something we've been talking about a lot on our side, is why we think this is happening. And there are all sorts of reasons. One is probably because of efforts of organizations like yours to really push this in the national conversation. And also I think people are experiencing climate change in a way that they haven't. One thing we asked other questions in this, because we also found big increases on a lot of these across the board. Like for example, in September of 2021, most Americans, the majority, like said that they think that they have experienced the effect of climate change. They said that America is being affected by climate change right now. These were both things that they had that we'd never found in the study before. And so people are starting to see it, I think, in their own lives in a way that they haven't before. So I think plays a role in being more worried about it and more wanting to act.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. That was really, really helpful. A lot of information. We'll spend some time digesting it, but it just a great dive into what the Yale Project is doing. So again, thank you so much for making the time for us this morning. You are welcome to stay on for the next 15 minutes if you'd like to hear more about what we're up to, but I do know how precious time is on weekends.
Well, and thank you once again for having me. It's been really great to talk with you all.
Yeah. Oh, we're so glad to have you. Thank you. So everybody, as I'm sure you can tell already, I am super excited that registration is open for the June 13th CCL International Conference, June 11th to 13th. We will be back at the Omni Hotel in Washington, D.C., and I encourage you to read through the conference landing page at cclusa.org/June Conference. Our speakers include heroes you're familiar with, like Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and Mark Reynolds. And it includes heroes that I think you'll love getting to know, like Wanda Ashley Williams of Climate Exchange and Alex Flint of the Alliance for Market Solutions. New this year will be breakout sessions that are organized around our work with members of Congress. And that will help us all become more proficient in working with particular ones we have, you know, maybe your House Democratic Progressive or your Senate Republican, for example. We've also built in more social time into the conference because we know you need to talk to each other after being apart so long during the pandemic. I think it's super cool that the post-conference lobbying is going to be done as part of our first ever International Week of Action in Lobbying. So again, read carefully through the conference page, please, and the FAQs, because we aren't going back to the past. We're going into a whole new future with this conference. And let me say just a little bit more about lobbying. Our DC staff is seeing and hearing that congressional buildings are starting to be more accessible again to constituents coming in for meetings. And that feels really, really good to know that the Hill may be opening up again. And we still can't predict how it will be in June, given everything that's going on in the world. However, if your liaisons want to try to organize a team to lobby in person, because there'll be enough of the constituents in DC, instead of a virtual meeting in June, that's okay with us. One of the silver linings of the virtual lobbying that we've been doing during the pandemic is that you learned how to set up teams, how to practice ahead of time, and how to get everybody in the right place during all those virtual lobby weeks. So if it makes sense to your liaison, it could work to lobby in person on June 14th if people are there instead of on Zoom. So you and your state coordinators and your liaisons and group leaders are going to know better than anybody else what's best to do. So we're leaving that in your hands. Now be aware that if you're thinking about this, about lobbying in person, it's absolutely imperative that you coordinate with your CCL leaders so that we don't have a situation where folks are requesting duplicate meetings. That doesn't make us look good to the members of Congress. We also want to help people come to Washington, D.C. There is a reduced student registration, and we have scholarship programs to help underrepresented groups attend, including BIPOC folks, people of color, and right of center volunteers. The link to apply is in the FAQs on the conference webpage. So again, check that out. Now, I have another guest I wanna bring on now, somebody that I love working with. It's Lene Pattengill, our Senior Development Director, because we're in the middle of our March appeal. So Lene, are you there?
Okay, hi. Hi. Okay, I'll start again. So as you might have noticed, we're in the middle of our March monthly donor fundraising campaign. I want to point out that this is one of only two national fundraisers that we have each year. So it's really important for our organization. I also want to highlight a unique opportunity that we have this year. An anonymous donor has agreed to make a $150,000 bonus gift, but only if we reach our goal of 15,000 in new or increased monthly evergreen donations. Increased monthly support will allow us to scale our grassroots efforts in strategic states and strengthen our influence in Congress at a time when it matters most. We need to keep Congress and the president focused on passing strong climate provisions this year. As of this morning, we've raised $7,682 towards our goal of $15,000 in new and increased monthly evergreen donations. Please help us meet our goal and unlock this $150,000 bonus gift by increasing your monthly gift or by becoming a new monthly donor today at whatever level works best for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lene. You know, you embody the spirit of CCL so beautifully in your approach to raising money for our work.
Love to do it. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah. Yep. We love our work. So everybody, here's a few highlights from the last few weeks. First of all, congratulations to the members of our two newest groups at Bowdoin, I don't know how to say that, College in Maine, welcome, and Minnesota West Suburbs, welcome, as well as a group called Yorkshire and the Humber in the UK. Welcome to all of you. Just a few days ago, the Hawaii Carbon Cashback Bill, don't you like the sound of that? The Hawaii Carbon Cashback Bill, it passed the State House and goes on to the State Senate. Our volunteers were all over this to make it happen. So congratulations to CCL Hawaii, and may the winds be at your back as the action moves to the Hawaiian Senate. Our counterparts in CCI, that's Citizens Climate International in Nigeria, held a press conference on the new IPCC report, and they had 7 TV stations, 5 print media, and 4 radio stations. That is just amazing. I want to learn how they get a media response like that. Here in the United States, our conservative outreach coordinator, Nate Abercrombie, rocked our latest conservative media tour last week. He had 8 interviews across the Mid-Atlantic and the East Coast, 5 on radio and 3 on TV, and that included a live appearance on CBS in DC. That gave him a chance to promote our upcoming Conservative Climate Leadership Conference that's at the end of this month. And then let's talk about what you did across the country. I love the Action Tracker. It tells me that despite February being a short little month, and it was very cloudy in my state, that you were very busy. You reported 113 outreach events, 24 endorsements, 74 meetings with community leaders, 221 media pieces, 2,195 calls to Congress, 276 social media actions with members of Congress. So thank you to everyone who took action last month. And a second thank you to all of you who take the extra minute or two to add it to the action tracker on our community website so that we know what all you did. You were my February sunshine. The actions this month are to do whatever you can to help us reach or exceed our March fundraising goal and unlock that $150,000 matching gift, and to continue calling for climate action and carbon pricing in all the ways that you can figure out to do that. There are a lot of suggestions for you in the March action sheet, so please take a little bit of time to have a look at that. And then that brings me to the context of the times that we find ourselves working in. I want to say just a little bit about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's a scary situation, and it adds more instability into all of our lives. And I'm sure you, like me, feel just awful for the people that are enduring it. So as you go through your daily life, you know, you and others around you might be feeling more stressed, and you may need to lean harder into the things that you do to help challenging times. So I encourage you to try to be gentle with yourself and the people around you. Sometimes an unexpected kindness just means more than you ever imagined. At the larger level, the invasion changes the context of our climate work. In the United States, we're grappling with the impacts of fossil fuel dependency, both financially with the soaring gas prices and politically with Russia's oil and gas production. You know, in the last week, it's become clear that a number of our elected leaders, including the president himself, are leaning into clean energy and climate action as a way to respond. And that's very good. President Biden took the step of banning imports of Russian oil and gas after bipartisan pressure from Congress to do so. And that was just unimaginable a few weeks ago. Here's what the president said this week, quote, "This crisis is a stark reminder that to protect our economy over the long term, we need to become energy independent. It should motivate us to accelerate a transition to clean energy," end quote. Yes to that. You know, it's also clear that others in our country are using the invasion as a reason to promote more fossil fuel development or blame gas prices on climate policy. And we're hearing renewed cries of drill, baby, drill, things like that. So, you know, as there always are, there's opportunities and there's threats as the war unfolds and as it impacts international relations and energy. So what can you do? Well, first of all, we can all hold our hearts open in the face of fear. And we can respond to calls to help the victims of war. And then above all, we can continue pushing for policies that accelerate the transition to clean energy. Yesterday, I met with some of the CCL staff to discuss our response. And one outcome is that we'll be revising our action tools to respond to this current and new situation. Because the calls for clean energy solutions need to be louder in the ears of our elected officials than the calls for more drilling. We just discussed it only late yesterday, so I can't tell you when that work will be done yet, but watch for it, for those action tools in particular to be updated. You'll also continue to get legislative updates from Danny Richter in Government Affairs, strategy bulletins from Tony Cerna, and media suggestions from Flannery Winchester. We're going to keep trying to get you information and things you can use as we keep responding to things that are happening out here in our world. So again, keep your eye out for them because that situation is ever changing. So in a nutshell, the most important thing you can do right now is to promote the notion that we can't drill our way to safety and security. And an essential response to Russian aggression is a shift away from fossil fuels to clean energy. So, you know, of course, as you've been doing, you can do it in conversations with friends, in letters to the editor, and in op-eds, or on social media. And then just continue the best you can, being the kind of people that remind everyone around you what we love about humanity. That's who you are. So thank you. Stay connected out there.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.